So let's start with Dave Nottig and I. Full disclosure, we were a bit slap happy here. We were tired. This was the last day of a very busy conference. But stick with us. Dave drops all sorts of wisdom on direct indexing, zero-fee ETFs, Bitcoin and marijuana ETFs, and much, much more. Take a listen.
Dave, I've got to tell you, I'm tired. This has been a grind. It's been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. I'm tired. I'm ready to go home.
They pushed it to 4 days now. We started Sunday in the middle of the day with some with great sessions, especially if you're an advisor or you're new to the space. They start with ETF 101, sort of a whole university day. Great content. And then 2 full days, you know, 8 o'clock, sometimes 7 o'clock in the morning with breakfast through the end of the night, 2 days. And then Wednesday, this half day that we're in right now. I feel like I've been through the trenches in World War I.
What does your schedule typically look like? I know I've been busy, but I feel like I've seen you everywhere, sometimes twice at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, over the years it's changed. Obviously, you know, back in the day, ETF.com used to run this conference, and it split out. And so then it used to just be logistics, putting out fires, all that stuff. Now, you know, I did a couple of main stage sessions, and then everybody's shooting video here, including us, and I think that's become one of the major ways that people get the content out of this conference. Obviously, I have a team of writers and editors here writing content for ETF.com, so there's a process there too, but I think we shot 20 videos over a 2-day shooting window. And then just, you know, meeting people, right? This is the mecca of the ETF industry, so if you want to talk to, I don't know, a portfolio manager from PIMCO to find out what they're thinking about interest rates, this is the place to do it.
Well, let's talk about your main stage presentation that you did with Matt Hogan. This is something you guys do every year. You offer sort of a state of the ETF union. And there are some interesting stats. One was that since 2009, ETFs have taken in $2.3 trillion. Mutual funds have lost $92 billion. And so that sort of set the stage for your presentation, certainly talked about the growth of ETFs, but it was interesting. You pivoted sort of mainstream in that presentation and talked about what the future may look like.
Right.
And talked about how there's always been fund evolution. And the topic of direct indexing came up and how mm-hmm. that could potentially pose a threat to ETFs and certainly mutual funds. First, high level, can you just explain what direct indexing is?
Oh, sure. So, and this is not a new concept. Institutions have been doing this forever. You know, if you want to own the S&P 500, but you're an Apple employee, you probably shouldn't have Apple be your largest position in your S&P 500 allocation. That's really tough to do. I mean, just that one thing, as you know, this is a financial advisor. You have clients who come in, they're heavily concentrated in their lives somewhere. You probably shouldn't double down. Really tough to do if you're that, you know, that Apple employee with that big Apple stock position sitting in options. You're probably legally not allowed to short out Apple from your SPY exposure. And certainly it would look bad when you talk to your boss about it. So how do you buy the 499 other stocks? So direct indexing is a way to solve that problem, to be able to say, I'm going to take the intellectual property of an index, but I'm going to tweak it because not every person is the same. And even the same exposure will have different impacts on different people based on what else they own, based on what their other exposures are.
Well, so you call this the great unwrapping,
right?
Because it's not in a traditional 40 Act wrapper. How big of a threat do you really think this is longer term? Is this something that is an existential threat to the status quo of funds, or is this something that maybe might take a little bit of market share? How big of a threat is this?
So I think people misinterpreted, you know, Michael Lewis, who was also here, had a great quote that, you know, as an author, you write the book, and then as a reader, you read the book, and it's only occasionally that those things are connected, right? People read what they want to read. The point I was making, I actually, in our prediction for the ETF market, we're actually more bullish on the next 10 years for ETFs than we were 10 years ago. I actually pulled in my prediction of when I think ETF assets cross mutual funds by a year to 2024. So I actually think ETF growth is accelerating. What I'm talking about with the direct indexing models, or you know, however we want to call these, the unwrapped model, is not an existential threat that gets rid of mutual funds or ETFs. It's the next thing that starts attracting assets. So as an, if you are a young advisor building a practice, you're 25 years old, you're going after that great $30 trillion millennial wealth transfer, you know, should you be focused on closed-end funds? Of course not. That wouldn't be where you would go. You'd focus probably on ETFs. The point we're making is the next thing coming down the line as an advisor is going to be the ability to really customize the portfolios for your customers, not at an asset allocation level, but back at that single security level. Now, nobody wants to do that. You don't want to go get 3,000 stocks for your clients. And so direct indexing is a way of solving that problem without all the complications of running a, you know, 1970s era 200 stock portfolio for every client.
Okay, so I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate. When you use the word customize, I think active management. And so if an investor has the ability or an advisor has the ability to start screening out things they don't want to own, let's say it's gun stocks or Apple stock, at some point you're introducing fairly significant active management into the process, potential tracking error. There are transaction costs involved with executing those trades. You may have somebody who maybe doesn't understand the tax implications of what they're doing. Obviously, tax loss harvesting can be beneficial at the individual security level, but you could have somebody sell out of a position because maybe they don't want to own, you know, some subset of stocks. Isn't it really active management in disguise? And not that that's necessarily bad, but that has certainly proven to trip up investors in the past.
Yeah, so I think you have to separate the sort of I have a gut feeling about Microsoft thing from the I'm tweaking my asset allocation for my circumstances. You do this right now. Wait, you have a client walk in the door. You have to make a choice about whether their large cap exposure is Russell 1000 or S&P 500 or MSCI 350, right? I mean, these are plain vanilla 10 basis point beta products that all say large cap U.S. equity on the cover. And they have different portfolios in them, right? And they're 150 stocks different between the MSCI 350 and the S&P 500, right? That's a huge, that's an active bet. You made an active bet on 150 stocks you don't or do want to own. And all we're doing here is saying, instead of just relying on the index provider to say, no, our sauce tastes better than the next person's sauce, how about have that sauce be relative to your client's actual needs, demands, wishes, and wants? Now, I'm not suggesting the whole market's going to flip this way next week. I think I'm probably going to retire in the ETF industry. I just think that this is where asset management and particularly the relationship between advisors and their clients is headed 10 years, right? That's where it's going to go. And the thing I think that people should be most worried about is when you think about investing this way, it's fundamentally a software problem, right? All the things you're talking about, like, you know, tax loss harvesting and, you know, introducing tracking error and how do I control for that? How do I manage that so that I don't end up with a portfolio that looks crazy, unlike what I wanted for basic exposure? All of those are software problems. And, you know, the industry, the ETF industry, isn't necessarily that great at software, right? They're great at packaging up products in wrappers. Who's great at software? Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook, those big companies. They also all happen to have big brand, big distribution. That's where it could start being an existential threat, but not to advisors, not to investors, not to index providers, to issuers.
Okay, let's talk about another topic that I was a bit surprised at, I guess the way this was positioned, zero fee ETFs. And I thought there might be more discussion around that, but it actually feels like the industry is perhaps now drawing a line in the sand and they're pushing back a little bit.
I wonder why, Nate.
Well, so there was a great quote. State Street's Rory Tobin was asked the question, is the right price for simple beta zero? And his response was, the right price for anything you value would never be zero. And in just conversations that I had, it definitely feels like, look, somebody's going to come out with a zero fee ETF. I think we both can agree on that. But it does feel like the industry saying, hey, look, we're down at a few basis points. A basis point here or there doesn't matter. Do you think we have reached a bottom on fees? Again, notwithstanding somebody will launch a zero fee ETF at some point, but in general, do you think we've reached kind of that floor on fees?
I don't think anybody cares too much about the difference between 8 and 7 basis points. I think they care about the difference between 80 basis points and 7 basis points. And those fee battles still have to be fought, right? There are still corners of this market that I think are very expensive. Look, I put up on stage during our best new ETF smackdown a series of products from Innovator. We've talked about them several times on the show, the defined outcome products. They're legitimately expensive. They're like 79 basis points. Now, it's a tough strategy to manage. It requires a lot of thought. It's got trading that needs to happen. So it's not necessarily the wrong price, but could it be half of that? And would that be better for investors? Of course. So I think what you're going to see is, you know, sort of like with audio, you compress things down, but the sound never goes away. I think we're going to see that compression continue to happen, but the center of the compression isn't going to be zero. It's going to be 10 basis points or something like that. So we'll see people arguing for the value of their products, to Rory's point, arguing for the value of their products over beta based on the exposures, based on the expected performance, based on their risk management. So I don't think we're going to see zero as much more than a gimmick really in my lifetime.
You mentioned the Innovator ETF. So every year, there's something called the Battle of the Pundits, and there's a fantastic group of ETF gurus who basically get up on the main stage and make a presentation for the best new ETF of the past year, so best new ETF of 2018. So Eric Balchunas, Matt Hogan, Ben Johnson from Morningstar, Elizabeth Kashner from FactSet, Tom Lyon at ETF Trends, yourself, and, of course, Todd Rosenbluth over at CFRA. Some great tickers were out there. So Eric had the Perth Gold ETF, physical gold ETF, which I think you had the rebuttal to, if I remember correctly. Matt Hogan had the eSports ETF.
And one.
And one from VanEck. Ben Johnson had a Vanguard multi-factor. Elizabeth had one of the JP Morgan, I think the Japan
beta builder.
Beta builders. Tom had XLC, right? Communications. And then Todd had Deutsche, the X-Trackers.
Right. The
QARP,
right? Quality at a reasonable price.
So right. I would love your take. You have the first opportunity to tell us who you think should have won, assuming not yourself.
Right.
I'll tell you who I think should have won. What was your take on how this all went down? So you already mentioned Matt Hogan won with eSports.
Right. Well, we should point out to listeners who are not in the audience and are reading this coverage, and look, we take the winner of this, and they show up at the ETF.com awards in March. So it looks,
I didn't know that, actually.
It looks quite serious on paper, but I think it's worth saying that the genesis of this was, this is a window in the conference that over 10 years is very difficult to get people in the room. It's the second to last session of the day. The last session of the day, you always put, like this year, Joe Montana or something like that. You do some big thing to get people back in the room, to send people off happy to cocktail hour. But the presentation right before that is always impossible because everybody's like, it's Florida, it's 4 o'clock, we could have beer, if nobody would mind. And so because of that, they don't want to put something super important there that may not have a brand name.
That makes sense. And it was a packed session, we should say.
It was this time. The first year we did this, we had 100 people in the room at a 2,000-person conference.
And we should also mention John Swolf, CEO of Inside ETFs, actually wears a referee uniform and has a whistle up there on stage because the presentations are timed. Nevertheless, who should have won?
We're all very tired. We're having a lot of fun. We're all taking the you-know-what out of each other. That's the point of it. But we do take the process pretty seriously. So who should have won on merits? Of course, me. But who should have won other than me? I actually thought Todd Rosenbluth.
I agree. That would have been my.
First of all, it's a great product, like the quality to reasonable price product. I know some people think quality is like the new smart beta. There's so many new quality products. But QARP, aside from being called CARP, which is hilarious, it's a really solid product launch from Deutsche that people really are. Sorry, DWS now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That people really should look at. And Todd not only presented it very well from an intellectual standpoint, he did it as a rap, as a man who should never rap in his lifetime. So he was both entertaining, but also had, I think, a very solid case for why it was a great product. One thing people don't realize about that, when they see the eight of us up on stage, we do like an NFL-style draft for who gets to go first and pick which one. So I got to go first, so I got to pick the Innovator Funds. Todd was second to last. Nobody else picked QARP before him, which is shocking. And it explains a little bit why Eric Balchunas in last place picked the Perth Mint.
Yeah, that's
gold
a tough
fund.
One. Trying to sell the physical gold is something exciting.
Very
that's a tough.
But you know, you have to realize that Eric picked last, so the best seven ideas were already gone.
Okay, a couple other topics I want to ask you about that I observed at the conference. And I'm sorry, I have to ask you about Bitcoin.
Okay.
In the same breath, we can talk about cannabis and marijuana. So, when I was here last year, Bitcoin and marijuana, I would say more than anything else, those were the two hottest topics of discussion. This year, I think there was one session on cryptos, and there's one session on cannabis, but overall, not nearly the buzz.
Right.
Is that a sign of kind of where we're at with both of those? You know, my take is, just in having conversations, it certainly doesn't seem like a crypto or Bitcoin ETF launch is imminent anytime soon. I think that process is still working its way through the SEC. It does seem like we will probably have some additional marijuana ETF launches, was just my read in talking to people. What was your take just kind of on how both of those subjects were presented this year and just kind of the overall feel around both
of those? So, I mean, I think last year these were very new ideas. And now this year we're sort of in this, you know, I don't know if there's a smile, we're at the bottom of it, right? Where the initial products are filed. In the case of MJ, the initial product is out and traded and has been reasonably successful, at least in gathering assets. Now we're in this sort of regulatory lull. And, you know, if you were putting this conference together as an organizer and you're looking back, I don't know, October or something like that, and you're looking at the SEC agenda, it was pretty clear that nothing was going to be magically approved on December 31st to go into the new year. So we're in this regulatory lull where there's not a lot to talk about in terms of new product for an ETF.
So you think it's more regulatory driven just in terms of the lack of buzz right now?
Well, also, it's inarguable that marijuana stocks have taken it on the chin lately. And look at Bitcoin is like one of the greatest bear market stories in history over the last 18 months, right? So, I know that you and Connor talk often about Bitcoin in different contexts. It's super interesting. Obviously, I'm really interested in it too. But I think we're also pretty clear-eyed about what it is and what it isn't. Nobody's talking about making 40% allocations to Bitcoin, at least not coming back on this show. So, you know, I think we have to recognize, look, this is a really interesting part of the market, but right now it's not the most relevant topic for an actual investor putting money to work.
Okay, what about ESG? So this was another topic last year that I think had a fair amount of buzz. This year, that trend continued. There was an excellent presentation by Paul Tudor Jones. Mm-hmm. On the Just ETF.
Just Capital, right, and which is the index behind Goldman Sachs. JUST
That's
ETF, right.
Right. And he was a fantastic messenger.
Well, he's a great speaker, obviously, and, you know, incredible resume.
I said I'm surprised he hasn't run for office, I mean, with as well as he presented. But what are your thoughts on ESG? I know we've talked a lot about it on past podcasts. Continues to be just a tremendous amount of attention on it. Asset flows are still light. Where are we with ESG?
Yeah, so I was actually surprised, too, how positive the reaction to ESG topics here was. There were a couple. So obviously there was the Paul Tudor Jones presentation. There was a great panel with a handful of folks, including the woman from ESGI, Ms. Lee, who's phenomenal. I think that there is a growing realization that ESG is not just I'm a tree hugger, I want to go do a thing. It's actually kind of a core part of the investment process. And you can ignore it, right? Like, just like you can ignore worrying about duration in your bond exposure and just buy the ag. So you can ignore it, but there's value to be had in thinking about it. And whether that's risk reduction, whether that's sort of outperformance, whether that's trying to actually have impact through your investments, there are a lot of facets to it. I think part of the reason it's getting a little more play than I expected is some of the focus on corporate governance. And that some of that comes to do with what happened in the midterms and a little bit of shift in investor thinking about the role of corporations in the economy. There's been a lot of press just in the last few weeks on buybacks. And it's been very polar. It's been somewhat vitriolic. I mean, I've read a few op-eds about how, you know, buybacks are immoral or, you know, we're using tax cuts to fund buybacks to, you know, juice the investor class, but we can't fund healthcare. So it's become like that is an ESG discussion.
Is that good or bad, though? Because I do think a lot of people tend to wrap sort of the political discussion into ESG, and sometimes it may be viewed through a political spectrum. Is that good or is that bad?
Well, whether it's good or bad, it's complicating, right? So from our perspective, it makes it interesting, so we can talk about it. I think it's good in the sense that it's the right conversation to have. I'm not going to sit here and be pedantic and say what the answer is. But I think the role of corporations and governance and how they treat employees and how we allocate capital as a society, the role of government in that, those are legitimate things that we as a country should discuss. And it's a legitimate thing for an investor to be worried about. Part of the reason I think the Just Capital thing resonated so well, aside from the fact that Paul Tudor Jones is a great speaker and has some great ideas, is that instead of saying this is what matters, he was saying, hey, you know what? You tell us what matters. And that's what's different about the Just approach, is that they actually survey the American people and say, what do you care about? And they come back and say things like, well, how companies treat their workers is really important. Okay, we're going to allocate more capital to companies that we believe are treating their workers well because that's what you told us. And that's a very different approach than saying, here's our portfolio that doesn't have gun stocks in it. Do you want to buy it? I still believe that ESG is a pretty personal thing, and this is part of my shtick on direct indexing. Much easier to implement this accurately for your client as an advisor if you can tweak those things, if those are just sliders on a scale. I think the problem with ESG in an ETF or a mutual fund format is it's going to be one size fits all no matter what.
Well, and that's why I thought Paul Tudor Jones was such a good messenger, because yep. He was able to distill the message down to something that I think was more compelling and understandable. All right, last question. Obviously, inside ETFs, a big focus is ETF education. There are a lot of financial advisors here. But I had a really interesting conversation with someone named Sarah Newton. So she's out on social media, has a really large social media following, delusional trader, I think is a handle she has. But she kind of trades on her own. But in talking to her, she was like, hey, you know, the conference is really good. I've learned a lot, but there's not a whole lot of individual investors around here. And I don't know that that was her expectation. I think she knew it was more of an industry-focused conference. But what she said was, you know, she wondered how much the ETF message is actually making its way out to individual investors. And that almost there's a bit of an echo chamber within the ETF industry where advisors understand what's going on. They understand, you know, all the things that we're talking about here. But that the end investor is still maybe not understanding some of the potential benefits of ETFs and some of the different strategies that they can capture in an ETF wrapper. I'm just curious, do you have any thoughts on that? Do you feel like it is a bit of an echo chamber? You know, we're obviously focused on ETF education, ETF.com, ETF education. Is it a problem? And if it is, how do we get the message out to individuals?
Well, I think it's inarguable that it's an echo chamber, because that's the nature of these types of businesses, right? I mean, you go to the NAB show where they do audio, you know, the big audio show every year, and that's an echo chamber too. Everybody says, oh, this is the latest whiz bang thing, and everybody gets saying the same thing, and, you know, the musician on stage may never care, right? And so the question is, how do those things sync up for the benefit of the end user, in this case, the investor? So look, the ETF education game is never over, right? I think people are always surprised how many people show up, say, at the ETF 101 here every year, right? It packs a 600-person room every year, year after year. And you'd be like, haven't the advisors gotten it yet? No, because there's another 600 advisors that haven't heard it. The challenge is to reach a mass market, to reach the millions of investors that are trying to save for retirement or trying to save to put their kids through college, you need a big megaphone, right? And this is a small place, right? I mean, yeah, it's a huge conference for ETFs. It's 2,500 people. I had a great experience in the elevator coming here. You know, a conference was leaving as this conference was setting up, and this woman was here for, I don't know, a lawyer's conference or something, and she's like, oh, what's coming in? And I told her, you know, inside ETFs. She's like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I'm an investor. Well, how many people will be here? And I said, 2,500. She says, there are 2,500 people who care about ETFs, right? And I thought that was very telling, like that this was an individual investor who knew about ETFs, who was shocked that there was this big industry. So where does that megaphone come from? It's going to come from the traditional places that spend the money to reach those audiences. You know, Fidelity, you know, Janus. Like, these are names that individual investors tend to know because they've had decades of marketing messaging to those individual investors. And a lot of those players are still actually quite new in the ETF space. So you know, it falls a bit to, you know, the Spider brand, the iShares brand, to the Invesco brand, right? Those are the folks that can afford to have a big megaphone to reach those individuals. Now, obviously, there's problems with that because they're going to talk their own book,
sure,
as they should. That's marketing spending. They should do that. But putting it in context for that individual investor, I think, is a real challenge. Even something like CNBC, which, you know, so a lot of individual investors flip that on during the day. You know, they're going to look at their portfolio twice a day or something like that. Even there, 25 years into the ETF revolution, the ETF coverage is still pretty skimpy. I mean, Bob Pisani launched a new show a couple weeks ago on Mondays called ETF Edge, and that's the first time they've had dedicated ETF content on CNBC.
Good example. Well, you know, if it's a challenge, that also means there's tremendous opportunity.
Sure.
And I think the presentation that you and Matt gave, where you talked about the growth of ETFs moving forward, potentially surpassing mutual funds, if we can continue to raise the bar on ETF education as an industry, everybody will benefit and we'll continue to see that growth. Dave, really enjoyed it. Conference has been a blast. Thank you.
Thanks for having coffee with me. This is great.
All right, so that was ETF.com's Dave Nottig. I really enjoyed that conversation, and I do think we hit on just about all of the key takeaways from the conference. That was actually a pretty good recap.